Thank you for tuning in to the Best of Movie Geeks United, a collection of some of our most memorable conversations from our archives. Tonight, a trio of very interesting guests, starting with music superstar Barry Manilow, who came on our program to discuss his latest album, 15 Minutes, which deals with the perils of fame. He's followed by Vincent D'Onofrio, and we conclude tonight's episode with character actor Michael Madsen. Barry's new album, it's his first original album of all new original compositions in 10 years, and it's his best album. And it's it deals with fame, about the kind of the need for it with some people, and when they achieve it, how it can change their lives, mm-hmm. and not necessarily in a good way.
Right.
And we see it every single day, mm-hmm. In a media culture that preys upon a lot of these people.
Right.
And so this album is very relevant to today, and mm-hmm. it's a newer sound for Barry. He's really reaching outside of his box to put together this album, and it's just an outstanding album. So I had an opportunity to speak to Barry on Tuesday, which is the date that the album came out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's available now. You can purchase it at manilow.com. And we spoke about the challenges of putting together the album and the challenges of dealing with fame in his own life and a couple of other things that will be of tremendous interest to Manilow fans out there. So here is Barry, guys. Enjoy.
Hey there, Jamie.
Hi, Barry. How are you, sir?
Great.
Thank you so much for giving me your time today. I just want to, right off the bat, tell you that you've been my favorite for the past 34 years. I've been singing your music since I was three. It's essentially part of my DNA, your music.
Oh,
so thank you so much.
Thank you, Jamie.
And 15 Minutes is the best work you've ever done, I think.
It's fantastic.
What I want to know from you, first of all, is how this feels for you, because you've nurtured this album for years, and today it's being unveiled to the world. What emotions are going through for you right now?
Well, over these last couple of weeks, as it's gotten closer and closer, this is the first time I've been terrified in a long time. And that's a good thing, because I knew I was taking a big risk here. I just got off the Gayle King show, who said, you know, I was a little nervous about this album, Barry, because I love all the songs that you do with all the violins. And then I heard the first cut, and oh, it had too much energy. But then she got to love the thing, you know. So I have been a little, I've been dreading this moment, and excited about it, because it is not your typical Manilow album.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as the day arrived, I was, as any artist, I was holding it back by my fingernails. Can we push the release date back another month, another year? Because it really is a risky thing to do. The whole thing is a risk for me, Jamie. It was safer to do the greatest love songs of the 50s and the 60s, and do a nice arrangement of Arthur's Theme, and do a nice arrangement of Time After Time, and all those were safer. But this is a little more risky. Plus, I'm putting this out on my own mm-hmm. label, and plus I'm 95 years old to do this kind of thing. And, so,
well, this is what's great about it. I mean, it is such a departure for you. I mean, you've dabbled in edgier, kind of more rock flavored music in the past with songs like "Flashy Lady" and "Nice Boy Like Me." But what was this a particular challenge to inhabit this style of music for this album?
Yeah, I did it on purpose, because once Nick and I came up with the idea that we were going to tackle an album to write songs about fame, I kind of had to make up a person who wanted fame to kick this thing off. And I imagine this guy being a young guitar player, because these days I don't think you'd find a piano player trying for it. I just thought he would be a guitar player. And the problem was, I don't play guitar. So I had to write, for guitar and be as honest and truthful as I could be, not knowing how to play this instrument. And so it took a long time to make this, to write it and to be in the studio with guitar players and communicate with them on what I was hearing in my head.
And it tells it's a story about fame, your album. And it's about a young musician who strives for fame. He finds it. It tears him apart, and then he has to kind of rise from the ashes to start again.
That's right.
I'm curious, from your own experience, how have you made sense of fame?
Well, how have I made sense of fame? Well, I think more of so, how have I embraced it? Because I was resisting it for a long time. I didn't like it. And it's probably because I didn't start off wanting anything like that. I wanted a career as a musician in the background. I wanted to be an arranger, a composer, a producer if I was lucky, a piano player, a musician. I loved working with other singers that I could support them, like I did with Bette and so many of the other singers that I worked with. I was very happy in the background. But when that hit me, it was terrifying, and it was the best of times, and it was the worst of times for me. I had to really make friends with this thing called fame, because it knocked me right over. And the way I handled it, and if I were to have any advice for young people who this happens to, because really, there's no school to go to when this hits. There's no book to read. It hits you whether you've whether you played your dues for 10 years or whether you just happen to luck into a performance, it is a huge shock. What I finally learned was that you have to keep your family and your old friends around you, because your old friends and your family will look at you and tell you the truth as you become a little obnoxious or a little crazy, which happens to all of us.
Mm-hmm. That is important, but also another aspect of fame is this phenomenon where how it affects the people around you, how it affects how they relate to you.
Right.
And it's touched a little bit on the album in the Letter from a Fan song. Did you notice that as well in your life, that people weren't relating to you the same?
Oh, yes. They're relating to an image. Your image walks into the room way before you do. And it was another thing that was driving me crazy, sometimes still does. My image walks into the room, and this happens to everybody, whether it's the greatest doctor or the greatest politician, your image walks into the room way before they do, and you don't get treated like a person until hours later, until that all finally disappears. And that is complicated, and that is very, very frustrating for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you listen to the album, it's been on constant repeat for me. I know it backwards and forwards now.
Oh, I love this. Thank you.
When you listen
to it... it's so important, Jamie. I know that you can't believe this because I've been making so many albums. But this one, to hear you say this, I can't thank you enough. Because you sound so genuine, and really, this is a very important day, and thank you for saying that. Okay, I'll stop saying that. Okay.
I'm so honored to have the opportunity to speak to you and share these feelings with you. So when you listen to the album, does anything about it surprise you, even going through the process of putting it together?
The anger that I can finally get to surprised me, and I was wondering whether, fans like Gayle King, who missed the violins, I was wondering whether people will be able to handle my being angry, because there are some songs that this character, and again, I lived through this too. I really lived through just about all these experiences, and a song like Who Needs You, Take a Hike, I couldn't sing that sweetly. I had to find the anger in that song. Same thing with some of the other ones on Winter Go Down, and I had to get to the point where he's by himself. I'm imagining him in a hotel room saying, "What the hell just happened? I slept through the end of the world." But I had to get there, and that's, that would surprise me that I was able to get to that anger in song as a singing actor,
It really is like being an actor, because you're obviously these songs are kind of pulled from personal experiences, but
weren't in the beginning. They weren't. Nick and I were writing about this fictitious character. We looked around, we saw what was going on in the world, and we were writing about somebody else until I don't know, about 6-7 months into it, when I started to put them together on my CD player, I realized, whoa, I've lived every single song on this album, except the very last two, where we are way down in this person's experience. I think, thank goodness, I never went that far down. I went down, but not like that, where I had to start all over again. I thank goodness I haven't done that. But I did. It's not an autobiographical. It didn't start off to be an autobiographical album. But I have lived through all of these experiences.
Another thing that interests me is when you, speaking of unveiling it to an audience, I'm sure you're singing a song or two for your Paris, Las Vegas audience and during the various concerts that you do across the country. Does it take on a new life when you perform them for an audience for the first time?
Yeah, there's much more passion than I cannot do on a record. If I did that on a record, I think it wouldn't feel good. There are some people who know how to do that. I've never really had good fortune going as far as some other people do. But live, yes. So far, I've been doing Bring On Tomorrow, and I have found the joy and the celebration in Bring On and the hope in Bring On Tomorrow. And I think the audiences get it, even though they've never heard it before. They get it, and it seems to have been becoming a showstopper.
Mm. Just two more quick questions. I know you're pressed for time. I wanted to ask you about iHeartRadio. They have Radio Manilow. You have your own station where people can listen to some of the music from the new album and some of the music that inspires you.
It's my favorite thing that I've done in years. Have you checked it out yet? Have you gone on?
I've been listening to that nonstop too. Yes.
Oh well, it's my favorite thing. I have no idea because I gave them over 300 cuts. I gave them loads of introductions, and then they put it together. And then I guess their computer shuffles it. Mm-hmm. And so when I listen to this, and my friends listen to it, and my band, and none of us know what's coming next. And, it's like, Jerry Mulligan comes up, whoa, followed by Friendly Fire, whoa, followed by something else, it just goes, it's a wonderful, wonderful experience. I hope it becomes successful because, I'd love to do more of it.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. And such an eclectic sense of music. I mean, if people really want to get to know you beyond your own albums, I mean, this is a venue to do that.
Well, and also, because of the radio these days, we don't get to hear radio stations that play anything but, that since it's splintered into a million pieces, when you put the radio stations on, you get pop radio, period. Or you get show tunes, period. Mm-hmm. And here's a station where they're allowing me to play everything, I think there was a moment in time where there were loads of stations like this, and you just never knew what was coming next, But that's why this is feeling very fresh.
Talking about the future, you've mentioned that you're wanting to work on a sequel to 2 AM Paradise Cafe. Does this include more Johnny Mercer lyrics?
Well, I've got 35, and I've written melodies to all of them. And I just was talking to my assistant, Mark, and I said, I think I will put one of the Johnny Mercer lyrics that I put music to on this one, because that's what I did with When October Goes. So I think I will.
It's gorgeous. I can't wait for that. And Barry, thank you for playing such a major role in my life.
This has been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
You've given me a passion for the arts, and I can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much, too.
Vincent D'Onofrio, this is exciting. We've been wanting to speak to him for many years, particularly for our Kubrick series. And let me tell you, the interview went very well. And he was receptive to the idea of coming back on for our Kubrick series. So that's exciting. Ah, maybe we can make that happen. Vincent D'Onofrio, Full Metal Jacket. That was the Kubrick movie, obviously. And he really came to the forefront in a big way in that movie. Mm-hmm. And he's built a career of really interesting, unique characters. And he had a long time that he spent on Law & Order Criminal Intent. I believe he was on that show for 8 years. And gained a whole new audience, and believe me, we've heard from that audience consistently this past week since we announced his appearance on the show.
Right.
He's got a lot of fans out there. He's really popular with the ladies, man.
Yeah. He was really good in that one about Robert E. Howard,
The Whole Wide World.
That
was
good.
Great movie.
And he was one of the high points, I thought, in that Vince Vaughn movie, The Breakup. I actually thought he was, like, really, he, like, for me at least, kept my interest in the movie.
I really like that movie in general, but, yeah, he's good at that.
But he was, like, really
in,
intense. He brought this intensity, you know, to that, you know, I didn't think was there. I mean, that movie in hindsight is much better than I give it credit for. Don't get me wrong, but I just thought he was just awesome in that. For some reason, he just, like, stood out.
And Men in Black, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Great
in
that.
He's hysterical in there. The funniest moment for me in Men in Black is when he's walking on the sidewalk and he's got that, I mean, he looks completely strange and he's got this kind of weird walk and physicality about him, and he stops the guy on the street and he says, "Where do you keep your dead?" And the guy's like, the morgue? And answers like it's just, you know, a regular old question in New York City. There's a lot of great New York City humor in that movie. Like the guy that pulls up to the Chinese restaurant that he puts his cat on the hood and says, Okay, kitty, just sit right here while I pay the rude cab driver. I mean, there's like great stuff in that movie. Anyway, we're getting off topic.
What else? I mean, Mystic Pizza, and then I always also remember him from that great episode of Homicide.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you guys ever watched that show. He was in this episode, it's probably the best episode in the entire series, where he plays a commuter who gets caught between, he falls into a subway train, but he gets caught between the train and the platform. Mm. And if they move the train, he's going to immediately die.
Yeah.
So they're trying to get information from him before he dies as to who possibly might have pushed him. And he is magnificent. That him and Andre Brower together in that episode are just unbelievable.
Well, his new movie is called Chained. It's directed by Jennifer Lynch. It is now available on Blu-ray and DVD. And it's a challenging, hard, dark film. And it's perfect for Mr. D'Onofrio. He talked to us about Chained and a couple of the other highlights of his career, and here's the interview. I thought that the movie, Chained, was very, very effective. And one of the things I loved about it was the fact that while not excusing the actions of your character, it found a humanity in this otherwise monstrous character. Is that part of what appealed to you about it?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's tough, you know, because there's two different definitions here. Like, one is how I feel as a person, and then the other is how I feel as an actor. You know, as a person, I don't have any empathy towards people like I portrayed, you know, like serial killers, spree killers, people that commit murders. You know, I think to cross that line and to harm another human being in a malicious way and to lay in wait to wreak havoc and to cause violence, I think is horrific, and I think is just one of the most heinous things a human being can do to another. And I think that they all should be put away and or taken out. I mean, I really do believe that. I have no sympathy or even empathy for those types of people. But as an actor, you can't approach the role like that. You can't bring your own personal feelings about it. Otherwise you'll portray the character incorrectly. So you can't portray the character like a monster. You have to portray the character like a human being, and that's what, in fact, makes him so horrible and so monstrous. And so one, as an actor, would, you know, just approach him as a human being and build his morality off of what's right and wrong and true and false. Give it a much different foundation than what you or I would have.
Right.
So you start there, and so it's, you approach it in a very kind of psychological way. You know, otherwise, you're not going to help tell the story correctly. You know, it has to be. The trick about Chained was not so much about Bob himself, but how to get away with telling the story with this kid, and what becomes of that household,
mm-hmm.
Bob's household.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's really the way you approach it.
Well, another thing that struck me about your performance was your voice work in it. It's a very distinctive voice. Can you give me an idea of kind of the process of building the voice for that character?
Yeah, I mean, it was just an idea that I had that I brought into Jennifer, and she liked it, so we used it. And it, you know, it was something that I worked on for a few weeks and maybe a month or so. And you know, it's just an impediment. It's an actor's thing that you can, you know, there's ways to do that. I don't want to bore you with actor details, but, you know, you learn techniques on how to do those kinds of things with your tongue and your teeth. And you have to figure out a way that you can do it without thinking about it and be able to say the dialogue without letting the impediment act for you. Just the impediment exists in you, and that mm-hmm. you still are.
Well, what
makes sense to you.
Yeah, it absolutely does. Well, what it gives the character, I think, I mean, in my take of it, I mean, you really get a sense that this character is stuck in a place psychologically through the voice.
I mean, that's the idea. The idea is that you give these hints of neuroses and kinks in his psyche.
I didn't ask for you, but since you're here, I'm going to make the most of it. You will have one job. You do what I say. You clean up my house. Garbage bags, mops, bucket, broom, they are your tools. Breakfast. You will serve me breakfast every morning for the rest of your life. You will not eat or drink anything without my permission. You only eat after I have eaten, only what I have left in my plate. You hear that? That means that I'm bringing one back. You have 10 seconds to open these locks. Every night, I bring home a newspaper. After I finish reading it, I want you to try and find stories about missing people. You cut them out nice and neat, the license, and you put them in the scrapbook. Cash. There was no phone in this house. The TV is off limits unless I offer it. If someone knocks at this, well, no one's going to knock. If you steal from me, you get a beating. If you try and escape or you don't keep the house clean, you get a beating. If you make me nervous or get in my way at all, a beating. From now on, this is your world. It is only you, me, and them.
I think about a lot of your great performances and you know, the voice in this, the physicality of a Men in Black. Do you find that the externals are a good place to kind of start and build a character for you generally?
I go both ways. It's a good question. I mean, I do both. I realize, you know, in the true sense of the word, realize. I realize the story, and I let that realization or those realizations of the story influence my choices as an actor, and then I and that has both internal stuff and external stuff connected to it.
Right. Well, when we announced that you were going to be on our program, you have a lot of fans out there. They're very excited to hear from you. So they submitted a bunch of questions for you. Do you mind if I just ask a couple of quick ones?
No, please do. Go ahead.
Let me see here. They wanted to know, Carol wanted to know, will you ever be doing TV again? Is it a format that you'd be anxious to return to?
Well, I do want to do it again, yeah. I almost did it again with Ethan Hawke. And NBC brought the project from us, but then they never made it. So I'm hoping to maybe that will work out somewhere else when it frees up with Ethan and I. If not, yeah. I mean, the answer to that is, yeah, I would like to do it. It just has to be the right project and the right amount of episodes a season.
Right. Real Blog Chris wants to know, they want me to ask you about the status of your film Johnny and Me.
Johnny and Me is kind of held up right now. It's not happening anytime soon, but the script is still mine, and I still want to do it at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to be made anytime soon.
And then, and finally, Blue Velvet, Vincent D'Onofrio Page, wants me to ask you about the you just signed on to appear in the second season of Tales Beyond the Pale. And I like those guys very much that put that series together. Tell me what your character is like in that.
We're going to do it. We start rehearsals on Monday, actually, and we perform live on the 2nd. I don't want to tell you what it's about, but it's a really cool story. And we do it... I don't have it in front of me right now, the information, but we're going to perform it live on the 2nd of October and in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so you should go on the website and find out where and when. But, yeah, I'm doing it again with the same director, Joe Maggio, and Larry Fessenden producing it. And this is a really cool story, and I play a really cool character in it. But it has more than one character in it. The other one that I did was pretty much just one character.
Mm-hmm.
But this has several characters, but I play one of the more outstanding characters in it.
I think those are really exciting projects. I like that.
Oh, they're awesome.
Yeah.
It's so much fun to do.
Yeah. Tell me about your directing work, because I saw your film Don't Go in the Woods, and I loved it. I thought it was so unique. Is directing something that you took to right away? Is it something that you're anxious to do again?
Yeah, I'm going to do it again. It's going to be completely different than that one. And you know, it has to be something that I have the time for, and I think it's worth committing a couple of years to. And the next one will be a little bigger budget, not too much bigger. I mean, that one we did for $100,000. And we shot it in 12 days. And the next one will probably be a little bigger with a longer, not too much bigger, but with a longer shooting schedule and a little bit more money. But that's what, I mean, Johnny and Me was going to be the next one, but it won't be now. And so I'm working on this other thing. But thanks for seeing it.
Yeah, I thought it was terrific. But with directing independent films, I mean, and you experienced the polar opposite of the kind of the frenetic pace of an independent film and the short shooting schedule in your first movie with Mr. Kubrick. Is there an advantage to limited time? I mean, does it help at all? Or do you always need more of it when you're directing a film?
I don't know. I don't know what it's like to have been Stanley Kubrick. I mean, he was one of a kind, like most of the genius directors there are out there, and there's not a lot of them, but I wouldn't pretend to know what it's like to be one of them. And I mean, when it comes to the films that I made or I'm going to make, it all has to do with how much time you can afford.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to do it within that time the best you can and have the most fun and be as artistic as you possibly can be in that amount of time. You know, that's basically how it's sorted out for me when I direct. I can't imagine what it's like to do it any other way.
Mm. Well, I mean, Kubrick, just to ask you one more quick question about Mr. Kubrick. For the past couple of years, we've been doing a series of interviews and special shows dedicated to his work, and we've talked to Matthew Modine and Malcolm McDowell and about 60 people that worked with him. And, I mean, he had a very special way of working, but I think there's a misconception about him that he was very controlling with his actors. And what I've found from...
Not at all.
Yeah, is the opposite.
No, he never talked about story or character or anything. Not with me, anyway. And, no, he would come out on set and he would say, what are you guys going to do? And you would do it, and he would correct a couple of things for his shots. He'd say, I'm going to put a camera here, a camera there, and I want you to move over there instead of over there. And then you would leave, and he would light it, and then you would come back, and you would do it a bunch of times until you thought it was he was done, and then you would leave it and move on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he was very much lens, like he saw things through a lens, and not at all involved in controlling his actors, you know, at all.
Yeah.
I mean, that was my experience.
7.62 millimeter. Full metal jacket.
Leonard. Hartman comes in here and catches us, we'll both be in a world of shit.
I am in a world of shit. Left shoulder! Right shoulder! Lock and load! Order! This is my rifle! There are many like it, but this one is mine! My rifle is my best friend! It is my life! Get back in your bunk!
What is this Mickey Mouse shit? What in the name of Jesus H. Christ are you animals doing in my head? Why is Private Pyle out of his bunk after lights out? Why is Private Pyle holding that weapon? Why aren't you stomping Private Pyle's guts out?
Sir, it is the private city to inform the senior drill instructor that Private Pyle has a full magazine. It is locked and loaded, sir!
Private Pyle, and you listen good. I want that weapon, and I want it now. You will place that rifle on the deck at your feet and step back away from it.
And I'm sure that Kubrick was a director that you had an enormous amount of trust in.
Considering my age at the time, I could do nothing but trust him. Yeah.
Yeah, but when you're doing something very kind of equally difficult, like a Chained, like this character, I would imagine someone like Jennifer Lynch was essential in establishing a trusting relationship with her.
True. I like your questions.
Well, thank you.
You're asking some good questions. No, I think you're right. I think that I only assume that most actors do it the way I do. You know, I can't imagine doing it any other way. So, you know, as an actor, you go in and you bring your character in, and the best directors leave you to it,
mm-hmm.
and only help you when you seem stuck, or if you've missed a beat because you're overwhelmed with the next beat or the beat before that. And so they help you hone this idea that you brought in of how to tell their story correctly or how to help tell their story. And so they, like Jennifer, she's there right with you like a cheerleader egging you on to do it, do it, do it, do it, and do it better. You know,
mm-hmm.
like do this and do it your way, but do it that way. And, you know, it's all very positive and you know, she rocks that. You know, she, like, really, you know, has a very kind of great attitude about it and loves the idea that an actor is bringing in this whole thing that she had no idea about and just thrives on it, you know.
Yeah.
You're right. I mean, very different than Kubrick, where he expects you to, you know, it's unsaid. He expects you to show up, know your dialogue, have a character, and perform, and do it the best you're capable of every time. And I think Jennifer is like that in the same way, although she's much more involved and hands-on in the actual execution of it.
Well, she's very fearless. I mean, looking at all of the films that she's directed, they're all very dangerous.
Have you seen that documentary about the things she did in India? Have you seen that?
I did, yes, yes.
Yeah. Great, yeah, she's so much like that on set. I mean, you just want to do the right thing for that woman you know, when you're working with her.
Yeah.
You want to do a good film for her. You want to help tell the story for her.
Kubrick owes a large portion of the success of his film Full Metal Jacket to Mr. D'Onofrio's indelible performance as Private Pyle, a young man transformed from a shy and awkward recruit to a monstrous killing machine. In this conversation, Mr. D'Onofrio talks about the development of his character and the unforgettable experience of working with Mr. Kubrick. I wanted to know, first of all, I mean, I know you've told the story many, many times, but you submitted an audition tape like so many others associated with the film, didn't you?
Right. Yes. Modine and I were friends, and we had met at auditions and stuff like that, and I was working as a doorman at the Hard Rock Cafe. I was doing theater at the time and working as a doorman for pay the rent, and he passed by with his wife Carrie one day, and I said, "What are you up to?" And he said, "Well, I'm going off to do this thing with Kubrick." He said, "You should send tape out there because there's this other part that hadn't been cast." And I sent the tape, and then I did a monologue from a play that I was doing. Put it on tape. And back then, it wasn't easy to just put things on tape. You know, it's not like you could record them with your phone or anything. It was, you know, you had to rent a huge video recorder, camera, and a big tape deck that you carried over your shoulder. And, you know, it was like a huge thing. And then you had to find, like, you know, an NYU student that could edit it for you.
Yeah.
So that you could send a VHS, you know. It was like a big deal. And but I did it, and then I got a call back, and that started the Stanley and I talking about the part, and it ended up to be my first film.
Yeah, so I would imagine as a young person that loved the art form of acting and film that you had a great consciousness of Mr. Kubrick's work at this time that you were offered the role.
Oh, well, definitely. I mean, you know, we go to a lot of revival houses and watch movies, and I was, you know, it was not only Kubrick's work that I was at that time becoming really familiar with, but it was many other, you know, of the great American directors and European directors as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was a time of my life where I was educating myself on film and had seen a couple of his films already but didn't really know who he was, and then eventually learned about him as a filmmaker through watching these many different films and reading about them and stuff like that.
When he started a dialogue with you about the role and about the film, how descriptive was he about what he wanted out of that character?
He didn't talk a lot about it, but he did say that, you know, he was weak-minded, and it was that and the pressure of the Marine Corps and the training process that made him, turn into having this psychotic rage, you know. So he did talk about it in simple terms like that, but nothing too in depth. But he wanted him to appear to be a country bumpkin that eventually turns into a explosive killer.
Well, I'm sure that you probably came up with some sort of history for this character. And I'm curious, in your mind, what was it within him that made him so susceptible to that kind of monstrous transformation?
I think it was the, you know, the strip down of all of what of who he was, you know, as a very kind of innocent, pure guy, and brought out the worst in his nature through kind of like humiliation and this kind of your personality being stripped down and being made into a killing machine. I mean, if he had been as intelligent as like Joker or Arliss Howard's character, Cowboy, you know, maybe he wouldn't have turned, you know, like many, many Marines obviously don't turn and they become soldiers and, mm-hmm. and some of them very good soldiers. So the idea that he was weak-minded, that he was able to be, with not very much intellect, be stripped down to nothing, and that his core, the core that was left was the fact that he could shoot really well. Mm. And the sergeant zoning in on that and praising him for his use of a gun. And then I think the psychological aspect, I think the pressure of it got to him and turned him.
Well, I think that's and what comes through loud and clear in the film, obviously,
yeah.
is that that's the role of the boot camp. It's to break you down completely and then build you up again in their image.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say that, you know, although I am a liberal, I am not anti-military. You know,
right.
I have met, and it's so weird the way things work out in life, because even though the film is about this, even though we're talking about the film in this context right now at the moment, you have to remember that hundreds and hundreds of Marines have come up to me
mm-hmm.
in the many years since I've made that film and told me that I helped them get through that period.
Mm.
of their life, that the training period, and or the Marine Corps itself. So you have to realize what a strange thing that is to hear. On one hand, you're like, wow, you know, that's pretty cool. And I always say, wow, I'm glad I could help, you know.
Absolutely. At the same time, you have to think
what the movie is about.
Yeah, but I think that they get what the movie is about.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Because I've talked to a few veterans myself in assembling interviews for the show, and all of them say Full Metal Jacket is the one that got it right, because there is certainly the boot camp sequence at the beginning, but just overall there's this intangible feeling that movie gets just right about the state of war, I mean, the state of being in that kind of conflict that no one else quite got.
Right, right. I think I've heard the same, so, yeah. It's just interesting. You have to understand, it's an interesting thing that you consider what the film is about, and then many years later, there are actual men and women that have used that film has helped them actually get to a period in their life. It's just an interesting thing to me.
Yeah, yeah. I want to know about Kubrick's working process, because as I understand it, obviously it's written about all the time about the numerous takes, but I want to know what that does to you as an actor, what that process is. Where do you start?
Well, I don't think, you know, I'm not sure that Matthew would say the same thing, and I know that I wouldn't say the same thing. I mean, I didn't get numerous amount of takes. I was present one or two days in a row where there was 70 or something more takes with a particular actor, but that was very rare. I have to tell you, in my own experience, I have to tell you that was not a common thing. That this big scene in the middle of the movie where my character kills the sergeant and then kills himself was done in three takes. And that's not including the special effect. And the special effect was done fairly quickly. It worked really well. A guy blew with his mouth a soaked tissue past my head to hit the wall. And we did that a few times. There was no explosive in the rifle or anything like that. It was just all acting. I held it to my mouth, and I pulled the trigger. There was no explosive at all. And I just threw my head back as this guy fired this, blew this red-soaked tissue behind my head. But the acting part of it was done in three takes. I only did my side in three takes. I don't remember how many takes Matthew did, but I remember it not being a lot at all. Maybe the same amount of me or maybe more. I don't know, but I know it wasn't a lot. Mm-hmm. I remember that scene very particular. I also remember hearing a lot of stories, like you said, that you've heard about Stanley doing many takes, so I know he had that reputation. But, you know, I don't know if I was lucky or what was going on there, but we never did that. I think the most takes I ever did was 11 takes, and that was because it was during the blanket party. There's a shot where everybody's getting out of their beds in a sort of sequence while the dolly rolls on a track. And so that was a very, he wanted it to have a certain rhythm to it as the camera comes up onto the bunk and you see Joker and Cowboy, if I'm correct, starting to talk to Leonard before he gets pummeled by the blanket.
Right.
Bunk.
Right.
So that was a very particular shot, and I only had to do it, I had to do it like 11 times. I remember it being really exhausting because it was a very emotional scene for my character, but, you know, that's what I was being paid to do.
Right. But could you feel the, as opposed to just establishing what you'd want to do on the first take and essentially repeating it each subsequent take, did you feel it evolving? Was that the kind of process it was in any given scene?
Yeah, it evolved. I mean, you know, Stanley, you know, I think appreciated actors that each take would, as long as they didn't slow the rhythm down and the pace of things, he liked things to be at a certain pace. But as long as, you know, he liked, the one thing I do remember is that he did like actors that would start at zero each time and not repeat the exact same thing each time, but do a variation on what he liked, what the actor liked and what Stanley liked. You know, his main directions to me were, you know, keep the pace up, you know, do it faster and you can do better. Just do it again, do better. You know, and nothing specific about that last take other than if I wasn't in the correct light, he would make sure I understood. If there was a line reading that he thought the words were better the way I said it or better the way he thought about it in his head, he would then say, you know what, reverse those two words, you know, and so that it was like that kind of a thing.
Well, he, and you've said this, you've echoed this too, but others have as well, that he felt when it came to the choices he made in any given film, it wasn't so much about achieving realism, it was about achieving something interesting and surprising.
Right, so you say, real is one thing, interesting is better.
Yeah, so, but you look at the performances in some of his films, and if you transplant those performances to any other film in a similar genre, they would seem too broad a lot of times.
Right.
Did you ever feel like you were going too far in any given situation?
No. But you have to remember, if I was Malcolm McDowell in Clockwork Orange, maybe I would have questioned him. If I, you know, but because there were so many of those kinds, that category, I should say, of performance in Kubrick's films, by the time I was doing Full Metal Jacket, I didn't question him at all.
Right.
You know what I mean by that?
Yeah, I do, absolutely. Yeah. And it must have been fascinating for you when you were finally able to see the film, because obviously there's a great portion of it that you weren't at all involved in. What were you particularly taken by when you saw it that first time?
Yeah, you know, it's weird for me because a lot of people enjoy the first half of the movie so much.
Yeah.
And the second half not as much. And I feel exactly the opposite of it, if that, because I love watching the second part of the movie. But number one, it's Matthews in it, and I love Matthews' acting. And Arliss is in it, Arliss Howard, and I love his acting. And all the guys that played the other platoon members, but also the way, you know, the City of Way stuff is shot and how it's so different than any other war film, the way it's shot, except for maybe, you know, the other one that Stanley did, like Paths of Glory. And so you know, I just see it's a strange thing for me because I can never feel what a lot of other people feel about that movie. I've always enjoyed watching the second half of the movie far more than the first half.
I want to ask you, too, about Stanley, the man himself, because a predominant kind of assumption about him is that he was cold and clinical and intellectual and very ironic with his work, and there is that element, but I think a lot of people miss the absolute compassion in his work because it's not sentimental.
I do think he was a bit not in a deep kind of narcissistic way, not at all in a narcissistic way, although I don't know, I didn't live with him, so I didn't know if he was had a narcissistic nature or not. But when I say, but I want to use the term, he was a little bit antisocial, but
mm-hmm.
not in a narcissistic way, in a very kind of no nonsense way. And I appreciate that because I never felt as if I had to perform for him or be intelligent for him or be as clever as him, because you were allowed to just have very quiet, long, nonverbal moments with him and feel perfectly comfortable doing that, because he was very much like that. He would sit. I remember sitting with him for long periods of time where nothing was said on the set. And he would also, we were often invited, Matthew and I, to his house on weekends to watch movies with him. Because he had this great old school now, but then it was state-of-the-art, screening room in his house where it was two full-on movie projectors that he changed the reels himself on. And he would have films from Warner Brothers would send him films that he could watch in his screening room. So in that way, he was very social, you know, just in a very kind of no-nonsense way. But on set, he wasn't cold at all. I mean, you know, it's something, you know, very interesting to me, for me, has happened in the last few weeks, because while I was shooting in Los Angeles, I'm back in New York now, I'm done with the film, there was the Kubrick exhibit at the LACMA, at the LA County Museum.
Right.
And I hadn't watched Full Metal Jacket in, I don't know, 15 years or something, a long time. And hadn't thought about Stanley in quite a while. And you go to this museum, I was invited to this museum, and the minute you walk into the museum, the first thing you see is his chair encased in glass. And it's the chair that he used on our set. And that was quite moving for me. It took me off guard. I had no idea that I would react the way that I did. And it was a very odd thing to see his chair encased in glass. But one of the other interesting things that happened is that there's actually footage of Stanley and Matthew and I talking in Stanley's trailer before I think the big scene in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's fascinating. And we could just from that footage alone, you would be able to see that Stanley Kubrick was not cold, that he was very engaged with his actors and loved them to come up with great stuff, and was very concentrated on the words, the dialogue, more so than talking about any kind of, well, he never talked about any kind of emotional place you were in or anything like that. But it was spoken word, the words that the characters were saying. And he loved to watch you improvise, and then he would type it all down. And then, of course, if he liked what he heard and what he had typed down, then you would have to stick to that dialogue.
Right.
But I guess what I'm saying is, my point is that in that footage of the three of us talking, you can see that he wasn't at all like that.
Yeah. I see it in his films. And to be honest with you, it took me a long time to get there. Kubrick films for me, I mean, they're different experiences. I watched them at 20, and I probably didn't quite get them or feel them as deeply as I do now, as someone nearing 40. They evolve with time.
I know. Okay. I agree.
I just two more quick questions for you, and then I'll let you go. You've been so generous with me. Thank you. I was just curious if you had an opportunity after Full Metal Jacket to interact very much with him.
Not a lot, you know. It's not my personality type, and definitely not his. No, not a lot. I mean, there were occasions when we, before the movie came out, that we talked. He would, ask me questions sometimes while he was finishing his cut, and one time we had a conversation of how I thought the movie was being perceived when it was released, and I was so young and so enthusiastic. I mean, basically, there was a sense even then that I had that I was, that this man has just started my career off, and there was I remember having the feeling that I think I'm going to be working for a very long time now because of this man, because of the film, any conversations that I talk about that I had with Stanley are all coming from a very young man who had no experience at all in filmmaking and only the beginning of my acting. But and then it stopped. The communication stopped, and I was always, wondering, when he was going to make another movie, and he came out with Eyes Wide Shut, and then we lost him.
Yeah, and when you, I mean, obviously we have great, unique voices out there in filmmaking, but what do you think we're missing as a film culture without Stanley Kubrick out there making movies?
One less amazing director. That's what we're missing. I think that, will there be somebody else to take his place? Yeah, I think so. Will there be, can you compare one director's work with another? I think it's a very difficult thing to do. And you look at Stanley's whole volume of work, he was a great, great filmmaker. And then, you compare him to, like, Godard or Truffaut, and their films are so different. They were great, great filmmakers. And so there's going to be a lot of great, great filmmakers, and have been since then. But, I think that now there's one less.
Yeah. Well, Vincent, my friend, thank you so much for giving me time. I really appreciate this.
Yeah, you're welcome, man.
All righty. Have a great night and a holiday. Right. Great holiday. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Michael Madsen. Man.
Wow.
Reservoir Dogs. If you think of all the guys that took a chance on Reservoir Dogs, even though, it was just a stupendous script, but this was a first-timer in kind of every respect. And look at the big actors that he got. And they said yes to a first-timer, which is more and more rare, but it paid off dividends, obviously, for all of them. But Reservoir Dogs kind of put Michael Madsen in a different stratosphere, and then he continued on with that with the Kill Bill movies. And then Donnie Brasco. Free Willy's got a family movie in there, and of course he's part of the phenomenon that was Thumb and Louise, and he's just the genuine real deal, and he's a true character actor in that
he is a working actor. I mean, he'll do 12 movies in a year because that's what he does. He acts. And I like that. I love that attitude. I mean, he just wants to work. He's
right.
not too precious about it. It's his job. And occasionally he stumbles upon, you know, a truly great movie, but he's always distinctive in every movie because he's got this kind of unshakable presence, the strength of presence about him that the camera loves. And so we talk about a lot of this in the interview. Here is Michael Madsen. Enjoy it, everybody. Hey, Mr. Madsen. How are you, sir?
Jamie, hey, you just caught me. I was just leaving the room.
I'm honored to have a chance to speak to you. I appreciate the time.
Oh, well, I appreciate yours. I don't do much stuff on the internet, and I don't even have a laptop. I'm very grateful. I mean, it's very nice to you to give me some time.
Well, you are the coolest actor on the planet, so I'm more than happy to.
Well, make that the title of the article.
Nobody tells me shit. You can torture me all you want.
Torture you? That's a good idea. I like that one. Yeah. Sounds
even
fun.
Your boss said there wasn't a setup.
My what? Your boss. Excuse me, pal. One thing I want to make clear to you. I don't have a boss. Nobody tells me what to do. You understand? You hear what I said, you son of a bitch?
All right. You don't have a boss. All right.
Look, I'm not going to bullshit you, okay? I don't really give a good fuck what you know or don't know. But I'm going to torture you anyway. Regardless, I have to get information. It's amusing to me to torture a cop. You can say anything you want, because I've heard it all before. All you can do is pray for a quick death, which you ain't going to get.
You are a true working actor. You've got so many films that have been completed or that you're working on right now. I mean, I see a dozen credits here just from this year alone. What are you particularly excited about from that list?
Well, I think that a lot of times you meet a young first-time director and everybody tells you, don't do it. And, you know, if I hadn't done Reservoir Dogs, that would have been foolish. And so sometimes you agree to do stuff based on a pitch or based on the fact that you're trying to give a young filmmaker a chance to make a movie. And by being in it, you know, he gets the financing for it. So sometimes I make pictures that I wish that I hadn't done because they didn't turn out to be what they were supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm only happy when I'm busy. And I got 5 sons. And raising 5 sons in 2012 is kind of expensive. And I have to stay employed.
Yeah.
I got a few things coming out, and I got a thing that I'm about to do. So I thought it'd be a good time to maybe talk about it a little bit.
Well, I got something. They sent me something on two titles in particular, which are Infected and Lucy's.
Well, I did Lucy's first, and that's with Peter Facinelli, the kid from Twilight.
Mm-hmm.
He actually wrote the part for me. He plays a pickpocket in New York, a very infamous pickpocket, and I'm a New York City detective. And one way or another, he pickpockets my gold shield.
Mm.
And it's in the paper that this famous pickpocket's got a New York City detective's gold shield. And he's running around, waving it around, and, you know, he's obviously making a fool out of me. And so it's basically me, the film is me chasing him around trying to get my shield back. And he wrote the part for me, and then they got Vincent Gallo in the movie. and Michael Corenti as a director. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those are good. That's good talent. And Peter's a great kid. I mean, he's a really nice kid. And when you get someone young, someone who believes in what they're doing, and they actually write a part for you, everybody wins, you know what I mean? I like it when it happens that way. And we shot the picture in Rhode Island, and it turned out to be pretty good. And so the same production company that did Lucy's put me in Infected, and we made Infected like right afterwards. Mm. And that's a first-time director. That's Glenn Ciano. It's his first movie. And it's a horror movie, which I haven't been in that genre before. And I thought it was done right. It was done the way George Romero does them.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis Hopper was a dear, dear friend of mine, and he did a George Romero horror picture. And I thought, you know, it's an interesting genre that I've never done. And I did a little investigating. I found out that there's a huge following for that kind of film. It's about a family that goes off into the woods, and everybody gets this really rare Lyme disease, and it turns everybody into cannibals. Mm. And I'm like the only one who doesn't have it. And I end up having to shotgun a lot of people who are trying to get in the house. And it's one of those times where the weapon worked out, and it's a nice Winchester pump, and I wore the white Stetson. I wore the white cowboy hat that I wore in Kill Bill. And it was, you know, it was nice weather up there in Rhode Island at that time of year. And I think it turned out to be a little bit better than some of those movies that I've seen. Some of them, they're either really, really good or they're really, really horrible.
Yeah, there's very little in between. Yeah,
I think Infected is pretty good. And
well,
so,
you talk about these experiences and you getting along with everyone and it being the set kind of everything gels. When you think back at the truly great movies that you've made in your career, were all the sets like that? I mean, does that kind of produce better work?
No, it's. Mulholland Falls was not very much fun. There was a lot of disagreements about a lot of things. And, you know, making pictures is not easy. It's not the game and the joyride that everyone thinks. It's a very, very complicated thing, and it has to do an awful lot with personalities, and it has to do with an agenda. And it all turns into a business equation at some point where if the picture doesn't make money, people say, well, it must not be very good. And even some things that are really good that don't make money, they never get seen because they didn't get proper distribution. I did a cop picture with Daryl Hannah called Vice, mm-hmm. that never got proper distribution. And I did a picture called Hell Ride with Dennis Hopper that Quentin Tarantino, the executive, produced it. David Carradine's in it. It's the last picture I did with David. Mm. And Vinnie Jones is in it. And it's called Hellride. And Hellride never got decent distribution. Hellride, you know, went to DVD. So, you know, I think sometimes the business end of things gets in the way of the artistic end of things. And, I mean, it goes without saying. I suppose in any vocation of life, you know, you have these things happen. But, I mean, sometimes everybody gets along and sometimes they don't, and you can't. At the end of the day, you know, when they shut off the machine, it's time to go home. And mm-hmm. sometimes you are made friends with people and sometimes you don't. But you have to kind of mind your own business and do your own thing.
Was that a hard place for you to finally get to kind of let it go after a certain point, after your work in it is done?
You know, I saw that coming pretty early on. I did a lot of episodic TV before I started making movies. I did Cagney and Lacey and Tour of Duty and Miami Vice and Jake and the Fat Man and Saint Elsewhere. I did a bunch of episodic TV before I started making pictures, and I figured out this stuff early on, and so it's you know, it's in the best of times, it's the greatest job in the world, and I've been all over the world because I do it. I mean, I can't think of a country I haven't been to shoot a picture. And but in the worst of times, when there's nothing happening, or if you have bad representation, you know, if you don't have a good representative, a good manager, a good agent, you're basically fucked. I mean, mm-hmm. because for lack of a better word, but it's the greatest when it's good, and it's horrible when it's bad. When there's nothing going on, and you don't have a job, especially you have five kids. I got five sons, and you got to keep a roof over their head, and you wouldn't want to know what my grocery bill is. And it can get pretty grim when things are not happening. You know, you can't get a pilot because people think you're a film actor. And the independent film world, there's like too many got made, and so that kind of slowed down a little bit. I mean, I always thought I would make a great Batman, but the chances of that happening are probably non-existent. But you know what I mean? So I've gone back and forth between studio pictures and independent pictures, but when neither one of them is happening and you're in that lull,
it's scary.
It's horrible, man. It's horrible. Yeah, it's just, it's like, I should have been a lumberjack.
Well, I mean, I think that's something that's not talked about a lot, is that, you know, acting, it's your job. And like any other job, you depend upon opportunities and work. But in terms of...
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're an architect, you draw pictures of buildings. And if you're a bricklayer, you lay bricks. I mean, if you're an actor, for God's sakes, you know, you go and you make a movie.
Right.
I can't afford to go on Broadway and play True West as much as I'd like to. You can't make a living that way. And so I'm kind of... it isn't the fantasy world that people think. It's a tough job.
Yeah. But when you're doing it, which, you know, a lot of actors say when it comes down to actually acting, you do very little of it. But when you do it, do you have a different appreciation of it than you did when you were first starting out?
Well, I look at it differently. It's not as mysterious as I thought it used to be. I realize that it's... The simplicity is usually the best way to play stuff, and I'm not really as I'm a lot more comfortable with it than I used to be.
Yeah.
I used to think it was some sort of magical process, but it's really more of putting yourself in the circumstances of the character instead of trying to. I mean, I'm not Laurence Olivier. I'm not likely to do any Shakespeare, but I think I'm a lot calmer than I used to be. Like back in the days of The Getaway or Donnie Brasco, I think I was pretty intense, and I know how to get there if I have to, but I'm a lot less anxious about it.
Well, when I think about a lot of your great performances, including Donnie Brasco, I mean, you have episodes where you kind of blow up, but I mean, there's a quiet menace. I mean, there's just a presence there. And when I look at you, a lot of times I think of somebody that you idolized, Robert Mitchum, because he had that same spirit about him, I think.
Well, it was him. It was Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
It was Humphrey Bogart. I mean, all three of them. I mean, they just had a certain. I don't know what it is, and if I knew what it was, then I might not be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of glad that I don't know what it is, but it's just, I don't think it's an actable quality. I just know that Bogey played a villain for like 40 pictures before he finally did Maltese Falcon and was able to, you know, turn himself into a leading man. And you look at Mitchum, in Cape Fear.
Yeah.
I mean, he's 100 times more frightening than De Niro in the remake.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you realize that there's a very subtle, there's subtlety to stuff. I mean, I don't think that, I think Kill Bill is a good example because the way that it was written was not the way that I played it. There was no cowboy hat, and there was none of the emotional kind of conscious decision of Bud. Bud was I played him a lot more decent than he was written.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like Quentin didn't want me to wear that cowboy hat. He didn't even want me to wear the hat. And he didn't understand that, you know, there was something. I bought that hat in Durango because I was making a Western right before Kill Bill. And I was wearing the hat to rehearsals. And he says, "You're not wearing it in the movie." And I go, "Yes, I am." and he goes, no, you're not. And I said, "Yes, I am." And so he let us shoot for a few things with the hat. And then he came to my trailer, and he had written a scene where I have to take the hat off. And it wasn't even in the original script. And so he knew it was the only way that he was going to get it off of me was actually write. I mean, that's the genius of him.
Yeah.
To have actually decided to write a scene where my boss in the strip club tells me to take off my hat.
That's beautiful.
Which when I took it off, it was so demoralizing because I, Mike Madsen, I personally didn't want to take it off. And on the screen, when you watch the scene, Bud looks so sad that he has on his hat that you know, you have empathy for him.
I don't know what car was you worked before you came here to let you stroll in 20 minutes late, but it wasn't owned by me, and I own the fucking car wash.
Do you want me to leave?
No, I don't want you to leave. I want you to sit and wait.
Larry, there ain't nobody out there.
Larry, what's your plan? That you're not needed here?
My point is, I'm the bouncer, and there ain't nobody out there to bounce.
You're saying that the reason that you're not doing the job that I'm paying you to do is that you don't have a job to do?
No.
Is that what you're saying?
Let's go to the calendar. It's calendar time. Calendar time for Buddy.
Okay, you working tomorrow?
Yeah.
No, you're not. You're not working tomorrow. You're working Wednesday. Here you are. There you go. Working Thursday?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Friday. There's your name.
Exactly.
There used to be your name. Okay? Saturday. There used to be your name. Monday, you go to... How about that? I want you to go home till I call you. Till I call you. Before you leave, talk to Rocket. She's got a job for you to do.
How many times have I told you? Don't wear that hat here. How many?
What customer do I have?
Not the boss of the customers. I'm the boss of you. And I'm telling you that I want you to keep that shit kicker hat at home.
And I don't think Quentin really counted on that. I don't think that's what he... Ultimately, I don't think that's what he wanted Bud to be. But it's the way that it came out because it's the way I played it. And he
was smart enough to go with it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it worked. And he realized that it worked. So,
Before I let you go, I want to ask you one more thing about Donnie Brasco, because I idolize the work of Al Pacino. So anytime I'm able to,
I just saw it. I just came back from Dublin. I did a whole ad campaign for Jameson whiskey. Mm-hmm. And Al was over there promoting a documentary he made about Oscar Wilde, the poet.
Yeah.
And so I was hanging out with Al. I just saw him a month ago. We were in Dublin together for like 4 days.
What's it like to act across from him?
Well, you know, we shot that movie in New York. And we used to start shooting at about 6 o'clock in the morning. And Al would come in around 11, drinking a cup of coffee. And I went up to the producer one day and I said, I go, look, you know, why are we all here, you know, at the crack of dawn shooting this movie? And Al comes strolling in at 11. And he just looked at me and he goes, well, because he's Al. He said, oh, of course, yeah. Oh, my, what a stupid question. I mean, he's at the same time, I'll say that there was one day, one morning, you know the thing that happens in the lounge when he's hitting the parking meter with a hammer?
Right.
And I get mad at everybody and I yell at everybody. I flip the table over. He wasn't there when I shot the first part of the conversation where I started talking to everybody. And I'm looking over at him, and I'm kind of annoyed that he's banging on the parking meter. And he wasn't even there. And he wasn't there until the end when I flip the table and I walk out, and you have to see him standing there. Mm-hmm. He had just got to work for that last part of the scene. And when he found out that they had shot that stuff with him not being there, he asked me if I wanted to do it again with him standing there. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't even, like, on camera. But and so I said, yeah, I would. And it made a big difference in the scene. And it made a big difference to me. But, you know, he didn't have to do that.
Right.
He really didn't have to do that. It was a very generous thing to do. And he's a very, very decent guy. I was in Vancouver. I was making a picture called My Boss's Daughter. And I had 3 days off. And he was in Vancouver. We were both staying at the same hotel. He was making a movie called Insomnia.
Mm-hmm.
And he put me on his jet. He flew me back to L.A. so I could visit my sons for 3 days. And then had his jet take me back to Vancouver. That's what kind of guy he is.
I got the power. Now you're under me. What do you mean you got the power?
Sonny got up.
Where'd you get up? Hey, Rusty's going to run the whole thing from the can. Sonny Red's got Little Italy. I got Brooklyn. That's why you served for me. Well, yeah. Why? What'd you think? He was going to get whacked?
Lefty thought he was
going to get whacked. That's it for this episode of the Best of Movie Geeks United. You can access our entire archive of over 700 filmmaker interviews by visiting moviegeeksunited.net.